Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now please join me and welcome a man I once called the Tiger Woods of the education policy world, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you, babe.
that at one point was a compliment back when I used it before, but now I think we'll take that moniker away from you.
There's so many directions you go with that right now, aren't there?
Oh my gosh, we should probably not go in any direction other than to say one less role model for America's school children.
Well, you know, in the view, listeners missed an exciting near coup here at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, yeah.
When Stafford nearly just threw you out of that chair and said, "Hey, Mike, it's my show now."
I know. Well, you know, Rick, you and I have it's been so rare lately that you and I have both been here for the show. But I have a New Year's resolution that for 2010 we're going to make it a much more common occurrence.
Boom, baby.
So I am back from my book leave. I will be out shortly for my
paternity leave.
Paternity leave.
And how long will you be out for that?
Just a couple weeks. So, and then then there's Valentine's Day. That's true. And then Amber's off to Bangkok later. I mean, you know, we just. But the point is that today we have the full cast here, and we're gonna rock it, Rick. We're gonna knock this one out of the park.
I like that.
All right, let's get started, Mickey. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
As part of University of Minnesota's Teacher Redesign Initiative, a task force is suggesting that teacher candidates at the university be able to critically analyze American society, in particular to incorporate, quote, the myth of meritocracy in the United States. In 2009, is meritocracy a myth?
I'm actually less concerned about that than about why it is that we've got these institutions which regard preparing teachers as primarily a charge to brainwash.
So, you know, the other questions we're supposed to address is to see how the ideology of being colorblind just continues institutional racism, which, again, we could have a long discussion about whether that's the case, about whether we should be a melting pot or a salad bowl or all these other kinds of discussions that you might have related to the touchy issues of race in class. But yes, the question is this what we need our future teachers spending a lot of their time doing?
Well, but the funny thing is these, right? I mean, the Minneapolis, the Minnesota program, as I've understood it, is not that you're teaching teachers to think about these things. You're teaching teachers that there is a right answer to these things, and that if you have not been fully re-educated,
yes,
you're not prepared to teach until you've learned the proper answer.
Oh, that is very disturbing. Look, and to be clear, I think we still have a profile in this country where many of our teachers are young women coming from suburban or small town communities. Some of them are going to go teach in urban environments where there are poor minority kids. I mean, they do need to learn some things about different cultures, about how to, you know, raise student achievement for kids of particular backgrounds. I mean, so there are some things around race and class that an aspiring teacher might need to learn. But it is not to be brainwashed into whether or not having a colorblind attitude is racist or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you got?
You sold me, baby.
Okay, topic number two.
Okay. Education Week reports this week that P21, the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, is raising eyebrows due to alleged connections with educational technology corporations. Is the nonprofit P21 simply a front to force new and expensive technology into district budgets?
Well, it certainly appears that seems to be part of their mission. You look at the people that are involved in this group. You know, Ken Kay, who I don't know Ken. You know, it seems like a nice enough guy, but you know, his background is doing sort of corporate PR stuff, working for a lot of these technology companies. The other consultants and staff, the people who show up on their board meetings. I mean, they all seem to be PR people for companies that are technology companies, including people that sell technology to the schools. So I think this is a fair question to raise about A, what their real purpose is, and B, why they should be given any role in deciding what kind of stuff teachers teach.
I mean, I come at it a little differently. I just reflexively try to avoid these questions of guilt by association or hidden agendas, because frankly, if somebody wants to make a buck off the back of American school kid and is doing right by him, I'm all fine with them making that buck. What worries me about B21 is that it strikes me as intellectually thin, as problematic, is prone to all the kinds of watery dilution of real content, which we have seen fad after fad, and that these guys, as best I can tell, are trying to strong arm and bully these debates rather than actually meeting this stuff fairly and openly.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that, so for me, I mean, the problem with P21 is that it just strikes me as, I have real concerns about their agenda. Mm-hmm. And the rest of this stuff is just kind of interesting page three gossip.
Well, shout out to Common Core, one of Fordham's sister organizations, that has been successful in raising questions about P21, both the organizational questions, but also the substantive questions. Okay, topic number three.
So we are coming to the end of a decade here. And question three is, what was the very worst idea in education over the last decade?
Rick?
You know what? I might go with differentiated instruction.
Boom.
Boom. I just might. It's not that the idea itself is bad. Let me clarify for the listener.
For people that may not understand this jargon, what the heck do you mean by differentiated instruction?
So differentiated instruction is that we decided a while back that tracking is bad for reasons that I still don't fully grasp, but it's a bad thing. So what we're going to do is, instead of having kids separated into different classrooms, we're going to put them in the same classroom, but then they're at different places in terms of learning and mastery. So we're going to teach them all. One teacher is going to teach kids at different levels in different ways, mm-hmm. by sorting them out into different groups and giving them different kinds of assignments within the same classroom. Mm-hmm. And differentiated instruction has fostered this notion, which has soaked up untold billions of professional development and training, mm-hmm. and enormous amounts of classroom time, where teachers are supposed to simultaneously be gauging the needs of 20 or 25 kids, mm-hmm. Tweaking their instructional techniques to fit the needs of each of these kids, and making sure that they have the materials and the learning aids needed by these shifting constellations of kids, as well as individual outliers on either end of the distribution. Mm-hmm. Basically, as best I can tell, we've done everything we can to make teaching so incredibly difficult, mm-hmm. that, you know, that Socrates or Jefferson would be at wit's end trying to get, you know, from 8:30 to 3.
Well said. Well, I'm going to go with No Child Left Behind's highly qualified teacher provision as the worst idea of the decade.
Mm. Again, from the man who helped to implement it for 4 years.
Tried to torpedo it for 4 years was more like it. This is, again, good intentions on behalf of our friends at EdTrust and others involved. Of course, every child deserves a highly qualified teacher, but it was defined entirely on paper credentials and led to all kinds of crazy outcomes where, for example, small rural schools had to have their teachers go back and, you know, go back to school for things that they already know how to teach. It was bureaucracy at its worst.
You know what'll be interesting in about 3 years, whether or not we decide that Race to the Top winds up fighting for a spot on that list or not.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, it'd be easy somebody could just say, well, No Child Left Behind was the worst idea of the decade, if that was your view, but it's not really an idea. It's an amalgam of many ideas. Mm-hmm. Same with Race to the Top. Well, you know, it is nice. It's nice that it's finally time for Amber's Research Minute. So, Amber, Rick and I were blabbing on that we went way over time on the Pardon the Gadfly, so you're going to have to do the research half minute.
And I was hoping you would ask me the worst question.
Oh, of
Can
course.
Can I just plug it?
Yes, what's
All
the
right,
worst
student-centered
idea?
Student-centered learning, right on up there. Student-centered learning, because we have taken that and hijacked it all to, you know, where? Multiculturalism. And Bob Covert at UVA would just be really unhappy with me for saying that.
Yeah.
But I think an emphasis on multiculturalism and student-centered learning.
Mm. Anyway. Now, the problem with student-centered learning as the worst idea of the decade is that was also the worst idea of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 50s, right? 60s, yeah. and 70s,
true.
Right?
True.
And you notice that Amber just endorsed uniculturalism.
I know. Wow. We should, I bet she...
New slogan for the Fordham Research Department, the home of uniculturalism.
I bet she was not a fan of the University of Minnesota.
Ah.
Mm. All right, Amber, what are we talking
All right,
about this week?
So I'll go quickly, try to. This week we have mixed results from the Math NAEP TUDA, which stands for the Trial Urban District Assessment. This is a special NAEP administration that measures what students in the nation's large urban districts know. 18 urban districts participated in the TUDA Math in 2009. We find that between 07 and 09, the average math scores for students in these large cities increased at both grades 4 and 8. But individual results for the 11 cities that participated in both 07 and 09 was bleak. Most cities had flat scores. Among the 18 cities that participated in the 2009 math assessment, scores for both 8 and 4th graders in 10 districts were lower than those for public school students attending schools in large cities overall. 5 districts had higher scores in both grades than did students in large cities. They include included Austin, Boston, and San Diego. The bad news, 10 districts had lower scores at both grades, including Baltimore, Cleveland, D.C., L.A., and Philly. It's important to keep demographics in mind, though, especially since the percentage of students eligible for free and reduced lunch is roughly 46% nationally in those grades, but ranges from 46 to 100% in the TUDA districts.
Mm. What was Mike Casserly's take on the results?
Mike Casserly was cautiously optimistic. He said, you know, we've got some good news, some bad news, but most of all, we need to do better.
So our team in Ohio, of course, noticed the Cleveland results, which was one city that has shown basically no improvement over the, 6 or 8 years now that they've been participating in TUDA. You got to give Cleveland credit that they continue to participate in this voluntary thing.
I mean, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to give some kudos because 7 more districts joined this year, you know, I mean, than the last administration. They don't have to do this, and they just keep volunteering to get, like, slam dunked on the education podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Well, good for you.
Though there is an easy way for them to not be targets of Mike's wrath.
Hmm.
What is that?
Do better.
Oh, nice. That's a good motivating factor. True. Somebody will do a study someday and show how the Education Gadfly show had a causal impact on urban test scores.
Ooh.
I like that.
Yeah. There's your newfound research chops, huh?
I like that. But the other thing is, how much does this help or hinder people in these districts? I mean, you know, didn't see very much out of New York City, at least in the last couple of years. Does that hurt Klein or not?
And D.C., I didn't include it, but D.C. had a little bump in fourth grade and Boston. Yeah. So there was a little blip there.
And you know, D.C. is interesting because they have shown consistent progress now for several years, even before Michelle Rhee. You know, people like to beat up on D.C. as the worst district in America, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, they're showing some real gains. Mm-hmm. I think you could say that Cleveland's doing a lot worse. Well, thank you, Amber. So what's the song that goes along
with these? It's just been really stretchy lately with the songs. The districts are still lagging, so we all like U2. So we have I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. I camped out for this tour, by the way.
Is this the rattle and hum version?
I like it.
You know, I was thinking you might have gone a Zeppelin. Song Remains the Same.
Ooh. How do you just start emailing me? Rick,
you know, you're dating yourself. You're just that much older than me that you go for the Zeppelin.
Zeppelin, baby. Mm-hmm. Just that much. Whereas I'm a lot older than you, but
I'm perfectly comfortable with the U2 references, just like the Kip guys, you know? You know, the whole story that they were, you know, the whole brainstorming night long, overnight brainstorming session was listening to Joshua Tree over and over again.
I would give Rick kudos for his musical knowledge. Last year at the Fordham Christmas party, he knew all the words to All I Want for Christmas Is You.
There you go.
All of them.
Did I really?
Mm-hmm.
Mm,
you led the group. You led the group.
I must have. But we wrote our own lyrics, didn't we?
We did. But you knew you could sing it before we wrote the own lyrics, so we had the tune. With all the lyrics.
That's impressive. Even more impressive is that we get to rate that reform. By the way, I don't want people out there thinking that Fordham is politically incorrect on this point. We have a holiday party, Stafford, not a Christmas party. Thank you.
Winter
I wouldn't
party.
Want our Jewish brethren here, Rick, to feel excluded. And he is invited to that party every year now because of his job here as the co-host of the Education Gadfly Show.
It's premium wages, well baby. eating steak dinners on that.
Yes, and yes, it is not a big blowout. We do the austere, you know, conference room holiday party. But everyone's invited.
Really?
Well, I mean, that's...
It's so...
Oh, let me make that back. No. I meant everybody that works for Fordham or their spouse or their child. So, for example, Rick gets to bring Jolene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's it. I mean, some places it's just the staff.
Right.
But so. Rick basically works here, so.
Yes. Rick is bought and owned by us. Yes.
Mm.
All right. Stafford, what are we rating this week?
Okay. Recent lunchtime vandalism in a Montgomery County, Maryland high school has the school staff on the defensive. The stalls have become a hotspot for graffiti and a great locale for hiding out to skip class, so the principal decided that all upstairs bathrooms were going to be locked during lunch. There are 2 lunch periods, so that means kids who are in class during the second lunch period would have to trek down to the first floor of the building where the cafeteria is to use the facilities. The building says that it doesn't have the staff to man the upstairs bathrooms during the lunch hour, and repeated incidents of vandalism and graffiti have forced their hand. The bathrooms will remain closed during lunch for the foreseeable future. For those of you who are potentially now fuming over this denial of the basic human right to a restroom, let me preface this by saying that this school is no trailblazer when it comes to locking bathrooms during lunch, or other times when there are lots of students roaming the hallways. And according to one commenter on the coverage of the story, who claims that he is a student at this Montgomery County High School, he explains that if someone wanted to skip class during a lunch period, they wouldn't hide in the bathroom, they'd just go to lunch. A second lunch, I'm presuming. Another alleged Montgomery Blair student adds that, frankly, I think the only reason that these quote-unquote security measures are in place are because somebody in the security office is trying to overcompensate for not being an actual law enforcement officer. Ouch. I thought this would be a great time to pull out the original Rate That Reform grading criteria, something to which I do not refer very often. We had two questions in the original grading criteria. One is the problem accurately identified, and does the solution solve it? So my answer here is maybe. The problem, if the problem is graffiti, then yes, kids can't graffiti a room that they can't get into. But if the problem is teenagers being teenagers, then no, making them hold it will probably prompt more problems than it solves. And why are there students wandering the upstairs hallways during lunch when there are classes going on anyway? So I'll give this a B. It does solve the immediate problem, but it's kind of like putting a Band-Aid on a gushing wound.
Ooh. Wow.
Mm. So, gushing wound.
So let me add a little context here. So Montgomery Blair High School is actually our local high school where I live.
Oh.
3,000 kids, very diverse racially, socioeconomically. In other words, there's lots of poor kids go there, but also some more affluent kids as well. Now, so at this school, it sounds like it's sort of on lockdown during lunch and there's all these strict rules. Bethesda Chevy Chase High School, just a few miles to the west, which is predominantly white and upper middle class, has an open lunch. So not only are you allowed to go to any bathroom you want, you can go to the McDonald's across the street and use their bathroom for all you care. I just find this interesting, how these different things play out and these different high schools in the same district just so close.
Well, wasn't the thing about the Bethesda school that they could have club meetings and meet with teachers during lunch? They could eat lunch in their classrooms. Is that the high school you're talking about?
I guess they could do that too. Oh. But it's also an open. I mean, there's high schools that are open high schools. The kids can just leave the campus during. I mean, it's just radically different approaches to whether you trust kids or not, or how you deal with these issues. Mm-hmm. And I guess, look, I mean, I but it's tough. You have an issue where you've got a graffiti problem. What do you do?
You make them hold it.
You make them hold it. That's right. I think what they need is they need some sort of graffiti, anti-graffiti club, mm-hmm. where they have kids that are like in the bathrooms fighting the graffiti kids.
Right. So the kids who eat paste, they can go to the bathroom and get graffiti kids will beat them up instead. Great. Yes. Nice solution.
This is why I don't run school.
I mean, the irony here is, so one easy solution is the school could just hire additional guards, post them in the bathrooms. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's extra dollars, which are going to come out of instruction.
Right.
Or going to come out of So one question is, if the kids are graffitiing, and if you don't want to spend extra dollars for guards to patrol the upstairs hallway during lunch, when mm-hmm. you'd rather spend those dollars on instruction, your hands are, your choices start to get limited.
You know what Terry Moe and John Shubb would say? Virtual schools, baby, solves this problem overnight.
Kids graffiti their own bathroom.
That's
down the
right.
hall.
Who cares?
Dad gets home, says, "Why the heck did you spray paint our mirror?" And kid says, "It was during the break between block A and B."
That mm-hmm. is all the time we have for this week. We will be back next week, though. But until then,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.